being created in. Mm-hmm. And no one is talking about the fact that there is no ethical consideration in it. Everyone's just kind of like, oh, this is so cool. And it's adding so much to my life and that it's making it easier. That's great. But there's no ethical consideration. And it's the fact that no one notices it's not being developed in a framework of ethics. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of open to a lot of bad things, feels like an understatement, but like a lot of oppressing forces or bias and things like that, that kind of just violate human rights. And I can't remember the exact quotes of it, but I remember that paper constantly comparing data to oil in the facts of like ethics of like oil being extracted versus data being used and collected, which I thought was, it was a very good comparison in trying to make, I would say, make people understand where they're kind of blindsided to an extent.
Absolutely. And I think my research also started from like, because I was traveling a lot last year. And like my research was totally different from what it is right now. Like I was looking at a very different thing. And it is those like e-border, smart borders in EU specifically that made me think a lot about, you know, because they have different lines for people who are like EU passport holders versus Canada and like US passport holders. And so there are different lines and queues for people who have different kinds of passports. And so there are different kinds of technologies of people who are actually, you know, making sure the security is in place. And so that is the point that made me think about, oh my God, like there is like a very differential plane on which people are being judged. And so people whose data is being collected on these borders is way different for different people. Like, what does that even mean, you know? So that's exactly the place that my research started from. And I was, like, super curious to see, because Canada apparently, not apparently, but it always, it claims to be, like, a very safe house for, you know, refugee claimants and, like, people, like, immigration. It's supposed to be a land of multiculturalism and stuff like that. And to me, it is, I think, sure, yeah, it's better than our southern neighbor, as we can tell now. But I think if we just claim something of that big of a scale with some tag, I think we let a lot of things slide, and I think it's important to question all the sliding things. And so I was like, you know what, let me just look at the Canadian case, because also I think a lot of research is like academia is very white as well, to put it very plainly.
Very true, yeah.
So it's really hard to it's really hard to find people who are doing the kind of intersectional work that you're interested in. And I think the Canadian, like, South Asian story is an important one to look at. And that's why I was like, yeah, like, I've just come here. Like, and I think there are a lot of people who are in the same position of, like, being very scared of crossing the border, and like, you know, it's just like, yeah, there's a big history, and I think my focus is on the history of technology with my thesis. And yeah, it is just very jarring to me the way that like smart borders operate. Airports itself, I think it wasn't my first job, but I think my second job ever was working at an airport. So I think I'm obsessed with
that's your driving force in life is airports.
No, totally. I think airports are amazing places to do research about, because there's just so much happening. Yeah. They are the hubs and points of like a lot of, and they seem to be so seamlessly integrated into our modern life that we don't even think about them. Like we just think about just crossing the directions, them. Yeah. You know, you just cross them. Yeah. You don't actually think about it as being, because they are transit points. You don't think about them as like being like infrastructure that are political and social. And to me, that is like, that space is super interesting.
It's because it's also the infrastructure of getting in and out of a place.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm trying to think, like, I've never really thought that deeply in an airport, to be honest. When I've gone to the airports, I've just thought, right, how much, like, how many hours have I got? Am I going to make my flight? Mm-hmm. Have I got here in enough time? Or it's been like emotional goodbyes. And then I'm just sort of thinking like, oh, I'm on my own now. type of thing. But it's interesting the way that you word it makes it like, oh yeah, it's a very important part of just everyday, not like everyday life, but kind of just like everyday life, because is getting to and from different places. Like, if you're going to be exploring and traveling the world, you're not going to be thinking about how many different borders you're going through, how many times your data is being noted down that you've been and gone from this country, you've stayed there this amount of days, this, that, the other.
I mean, even in terms of like cargo stuff and like deliveries and stuff like that, we're always like, there's always a boundary that you're crossing that we're not aware of. Even if that means just taking a bus from, you know, one place to the other. We are crossing boundaries of the maps. That maps are also, you know, they create, they present a geopolitical world to us, a reality to us, in a way that is, you know, like very stipulated, simulated. Like, these are the places where you'll find food hubs. These are the places that you find stuff like that. And like giving hierarchies to, you know, places to visit and stuff like that. Like, if you search for one thing, it will give you like a, you know, like a short list of what else can you find around there and stuff like that. So those little functions that we don't even think about, and we just like, oh yeah, I actually can buy, you know, grocery before or after going to school. Yeah, sure, why not? Why shouldn't I, you know, get pizza from here or not? And like, those small little decisions in the everyday life, we are actually making a conscious decision of crossing one digital boundary to the other, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. It really does. Because also, you think, like, if you look at borders, there isn't exactly a line that's physically there.
Yeah.
Which I know is, like, I feel like that's being spoken about a bit more in terms of US and Canada, of, like, where has this line appeared?
Yeah.
Why is there a line here and things like that?
I mean, there's, like, there's, like, a whole history of borders. And that's why I think I just gave those two papers, because I was like, yeah, this is a good starting point, because I feel like it's important to connect that with the practice of the border and the bordering of the border.
Yeah.
So the process is basically that goes on at the border. Like, it has been so naturalized that you have to show your passport, scan it, and, you know, like, take an image, or, like, I know that, like, the borders are like, or the way that immigration works in EU is totally different from the way that it works here. Even though we're trying to, here in Canada, we are trying to integrate a lot of those, like, you know, fast track things and stuff like that, I still feel like there needs to be caution. We need to slow down a little bit in terms of where we are inputting and integrating technologies. Because we cannot be putting technologies every single way. Like, AI should not be everywhere. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, I feel like there is a need to understand the way in which it is harmful for people of color from a gender perspective. It's just jarring to me that people who are even, like, auditing these technologies, for example, they have certain criteria along which they're looking at these technologies, but there's always a possibility of harming people unintentionally with these technologies, because they have been constructed in a certain way with a certain prototype and data model in mind. Because a lot of these data models, for example, are actually trained on just social media data, for example. And that's why AI has become so much easier to integrate everywhere, is because the data is so much easier to extract and get. And part of the reason why is because of social media. Because, like, we put a lot of, like, word entries, image entries, video entries. And so they are being scraped to create data sets that machine learning and, like, AI scientists are working on to train the models. And so to me, that is, like, to me, like, that process is, like, the surveillance aspect, the privacy aspect is important, but also, like, where do these technologies end up is a big question. And I think if that is migration management, it is a problem.
Yeah, because you talking about borders and things had me thinking about the UK in terms of England and Scotland, because there's no border control between England and Scotland or England and Wales, even when they are technically separate countries, which I find quite interesting, in that there's a border control if you're from outside of the UK to get into the UK. But once you're in, you're kind of free to move about throughout the countries that are part of the United Kingdom. I don't know what it's like if you were to go to Northern Ireland or Republic of Ireland, because obviously that you're having to cross a bit of water. So yeah, totally. I feel like that one might be slightly different, but it's an interesting thing of that there is a border there, but there is no form of border control there.
Absolutely. And I think, I don't know a lot about the like politics within UK, but I know about UK and the way that like refugees is a big question, right? And in EU and UK, especially migration from the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so the way that detention centers are being set up and like deportation works from the UK, they're actively using AI tools. And so for me, that's like a big question, because the Muslim identity has been so long, you know, equated to the criminal or the offender. And so if that's something that is also like is also what the model is trained on, and it is being used by officers who have that kind of a bias, so the whole process to me becomes very questionable, you know.
Yeah, and I think like also there's such big talks still to the institutional kind of racist or gendered bias in the Met Police, and that's not without, that's like without considering AI, that's just the Met Police as an institution. And there was an inquiry into it in the late 1990s, and then it was like, okay, we're going to implement all of these trainings and this, that, the other, all of these classes, the police will no longer be institutionally racist. There was an inquiry, I want to say it was last year, that still found the Met Police institutionally racist despite this.
Absolutely. I mean, if you get rid of it on paper, how do you change the way that processes are structured? Mm-hmm. If the processes is to flag people, even if you say that you cannot flag people on a whatever discriminatory basis, there will be some shortcuts that people will be using to estimate. And if you use AI or automated tools, it is going to use approximate terms. It is going to use, you know, it is going to form those relations, correlations based on the things that we don't even know. So like, to me, that is more like scary.
Yeah. And it's like, because the thing that was interesting to me when I read this article, I want to say it was in like the fall of last year, was that it said like on paper, the Met Police isn't institutionally racist, because statistically speaking, they had increased the proportion of BAME police officers to what it was before. The proportion was more weighed up in terms of BAME to white. But the difference was that when you actually, this is where I say that you need qualitative and quantitative, because when you, they had interviews that were anonymous with BAME police officers, when you spoke to them and they said, we're treated horribly, we have to endure racist like language and views and things by police, we're always the last to be picked for certain things. And it's like, oh, so on paper, on like statistically speaking from the data collected, it will not look institutionally racist until you actually go behind that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In which I find it very interesting, because then the director of the Met Police was saying, no, we're not institutionally racist. And it was sort of like, well, you have several police officers saying very different things of their experiences and stuff like that.
And I feel like those things can come clear with qualitative analysis, but also auditing. But auditing technologies is a whole different thing, and people have been trying to come up with frameworks as to like, what should we audit a new technology on? What are the frameworks that it should be tested on? Who should be testing it? You know, all those questions. But to me, I feel like as a person who comes from critical like theory background, whatever you want to call it, is that I feel like there is a bigger problem that can be seen from the history of the way that this technology was first implemented. It's not to say that, you know, AI cannot do certain tasks and that it should not be, like, you know, involved at all, like, blah, blah, blah. And, like, I feel like it is important to, however, acknowledge that these technologies have a history. And so from the printing press and trying to use stamps, because stamping was a big way in which like black people were actually, you know, transported here into the North America. And so like stamping became a way in which formal, like, you know, formal messaging or communication began. And so, like, that stamping as a process has a history of discriminating against people, black people. And so, like, you know, stamping people who were coming to work here, people who, you know, just to track them so that they, if they would run away, you can find them because they had a certain stamp. And so now stamps are became like such a common thing in like communication tool as like a way to authorize certain things and certain transactions. And from that, we moved to signature as a way to authorize certain things to the photo, because like photographs are not a common thing back then. So they used to like do portraits. And so portraits and photography, for example, have racist history. And same is for like bordering mechanisms, because they have like a very big history. That even though we try and like, you know, say that, oh, we have changed over time, I still feel like it is important to think about the technologies that have been kind of the same, the logics of trying to sort and classify people into categories of risky or illegal or questionable or flagging people. Those technologies have been existing for way too long. And they are such an important, like, that's what the AI tools function, you know, that's what they are supposed to do. And so I am trying to question those like things.
Yeah that's very interesting. We're gonna just take a very quick break, because just noticed the time of how long we've actually been speaking. So I'm gonna quickly play a song and then we'll be back to wrap it up. So this next song is another one from the playlist, another CanCon FemCon song called Unmasked by Halves off of the album Art of Floating. Now that's a less applicable album title to Is Any of This Real? But we'll be right back once it's done.
Tell you how I want you.
And welcome back to Intravenous here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Rebecca and I am joined by Pranjali.
Hello.
And we have been delving into probably more of an intersectional than just fully feminist lens into data feminism and bordering mechanisms, specifically looking at immigration and refugees, as that is sort of what Pranjali's thesis and research is going into, especially with her driving force of airports that we spoke about previously. And for the last like 10 minutes, we're just going to kind of focus in on summing up with these quotes from a paper that she very kindly shared with me before this episode, which I thought they were just very interesting kind of quotes in a way of looking at it. I don't know if you want to read the quotes or... Mm-hmm.
You can go ahead.
Okay.
I've read this paper like a million times.
You're like, the quote is enough for me. So it was, datafication is the new instrument of oppression, perpetuating injustices and widening inequality gaps. And I really loved that quote, not because it's perpetuating inequalities and things like that, but I just think, like we were saying, not enough people are noticing the behind the scenes of the hierarchies and the binaries that go into AI, that goes into technology and data and things like that, where you're looking at, so who's actually programming it? What inherent biases are they programming it with? Where's the money coming from? Whose perspective is it from? And because no one thinks about that, because they're just looking at how convenient and efficient it is to adding to their lives, they don't notice the like oppression that's happening behind the scenes, almost very hidden. And I've become very obsessed with looking for hidden oppression, which sounds weird to be saying, but it's become like a thing of mine, of like looking, where is it hidden in plain sight that no one really notices?
That's the sociologist in you.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, because I remember my co-host from my show Sociologic pointed me out to kind of how the sub is laid out. It's a very interesting way of where certain clubs are and what's in the basement, what's not in the basement.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was like, I would never have thought of it like that. And so since then, I've been looking at everything like,
what exactly?
Why have you decided to put this there?
Yeah.
And things like that. I like to call it the big sociological why, applied to everything. But back to the quote. What are your thoughts on the quote?
I think it's okay. So for the starters, I feel like datafication in and of itself could be a topic. Like datafication, what does it mean? Because datafication to me is a big process. It's turning your social media posts into binaries, turning those binaries into a formula, a mathematical formula of finding what's the most used word, or finding what is the gender of the person who posted it, for example, if that's the function that you're attributing to the machine. So for me, all of those different steps from the point of data extraction to the point of the output, so from, for example, just to put it in very plain words, from the input to the output, there are several different steps through which the data is being processed. So it is being baked in an oven. So I think every process is every single thing, from the data collection to the data storage to the way it is visualized as an output. You know, these are the vectors. This is a very common like corporate way to show that these are the sales, these are the linkages, this is our target audience, and this is the kind of products they're buying, blah blah blah. And to me, all of those different like marinations for the data across the process of datafication are very interesting. Very, very interesting to me. And honestly, I could teach a course on this one if you look at this point.
Yeah.
But the way that they succinctly like put this in a sentence by saying datafication is a new instrument of oppression, perpetuating injustice and widening inequality gaps is super important. The only sort of hesitation that I have is with the word new there, because I don't know if datafication necessarily is a very new phenomena, because like the way that datafication of BIPOC folks, people of color, people who have been, you know, who don't follow the heteronormative or like the white dominant perspective, have always been subjected to these kinds of instruments throughout the history. So I feel like the process of datafication is not new for them.
No,
if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I can understand where you're coming from.
But I definitely understand that the present form of big data, the way in which that they present as being big data, as being big oil. So I understand where they're coming from, but I still feel like there is need to pause on a few different things that they mention here. But yeah, this is a very good way to summarize our conversation. Love that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think as well as the way that you're saying it's going through, because obviously this paper was very much focusing on bordering mechanisms and a lack of an ethical framework. And it's the fact that you're saying, like, obviously with this datafication, they're going through different layers and things. And it's that each of these layers is lacking an ethical kind of standard. It's lacking an ethical framework to be able to prevent it being classed as an instrument of oppression. Because technology should be seen as this, like, great advancement. It should be seen in a positive light. And it is, but it's the negative side of it that it's hidden, but also, I don't know, the negative side, I feel like, could easily not be there.
Yeah.
To an extent.
And I think if we had more time, I would go more into the...
Yeah, of course, we're just looking at the clock counting down.
You know, technology as modernity, and what does that mean? Do we need modern subjects who are technological slaves and stuff like that? Like, you know, there's a whole lot of things to talk about on the aspect of the newness of the new technologies, how new they are and not. And I feel like for bordering, my project like specifically looks at what is the new in the new technology of the AI being used in migration management. And so I think this is a good place to sort of wrap it up, because I feel like there's a lot to say again.
Yeah, we don't want to get off into kind of another and say like tangent, which is kind of what happened last time, which is why we ended up doing a part two. And then we were like, after the part two, I feel like we're going to need to do another one.
But now I feel like we need to do another one.
Need to do another one. Just keep spiraling. But yeah, I also want to just leave on the quote that I think is very similar to what you said at the start, which was looking at the power differentials in data, and that the quote from the paper is, data is power. Who has power and who does not starts the conversation. And I think that's a good way of finishing up, kind of trying to sum up what we've been talking about, because it is a very big talking point of who is creating the data, who's programming and things like that. Those are the people holding power. And if you look at who it is least feminine and least not white, as a way of putting it that way. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me today. It was nice to actually speak to someone in the studio and not just play a recorded interview of me speaking to someone. And I'm sure the listeners actually also preferred to hear live voices. Stay tuned as we have Democracy Now! Coming up next from 11 to 12. And I hope you all have a lovely rest of your week.